Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about ghouls in Dungeons & Dragons. We're going to cover the very weird history of how ghouls came to be in D&D. Why are they traditionally one of the most feared monster types? And what's the best way to skin or unskin them, like Lovecraft or Liber or Romero or Gygax? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we begin our ghoulish discourse, I will remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host with all of our patrons, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms and pledge at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. And then around 10 after 2, we take a little break in between the show, but about 10 after 2 Eastern time, we'll hop on there and start up the after party chat for about an hour or 45 minutes, maybe. Dan and I will love to chat, you know, keep the discussion going, get some insights from our patrons, and talk more D&D.
I was just talking to Paul and saying that I have so much to talk about regarding ghouls that I could. It's probably going to go for a couple hours, and today it's probably going to spill over in the after chat. So we would love if you could join us live in the after chat, and probably you have ideas about how to use ghouls that we hadn't even thought about. So we would love to see you there today. Paul, I have written about ghouls in the past on my blog. I have some links in the YouTube description. People can go see some things that I personally grappled with about ghouls in gaming and literature in the past. So feel free to check that out later if they want to see more. Ghouls are I'll say, you know, in my gaming history, for my current play group, I think that ghouls have probably caused the single scariest moment ever in the gaming session. And for people that I introduced for new players for the first time in D&D, I was running through the sample dungeon in the first edition DM's guide, and there are ghouls in there. And there was a moment they got the players got into that segment, you know, maybe about three sessions in or something like that. And there was a moment where they got attacked by ghouls and half, like most of the party went down. Most of the party went down real fast. And one of the brand new players, like, grabbed someone who wasn't quite dead yet, pulled them around a corner in the mazy crypt area there. And the ghouls are around a corner. And I say, what's going to happen here is I'm going to roll a die for what corridor the ghouls go down, and 1, 2 it's this way, 3, 4 it's that way, 5 or 6 it's down the dead end that you've managed to pull yourself and your ally. And I take the die out in public, of course. I do all these rolls in live, and everybody was just sweating bullets, and our friend Lauren was just like, this game is the most terrifying thing I've ever experienced in my life. And if a 5 or 6 comes up, it's a TPK, right? And down comes a 3. And the ghouls go by, and they manage to pull themselves out and avoid the TPK based on that one single die roll. And I think that terrified everybody, in particular the new players, with how totally ferocious the ghouls were. And I think that still sticks in everybody's head years later.
Dan, you and I have talked about ghouls separately, I think, a lot, honestly. So much so that when we were setting up for this show, I actually went back and looked at our log just to be like, surely we've already done ghouls. We must have already done ghouls, but I guess not, right? And I know that you struggled with them, I think, a little bit when you were working on your EHD calculator, because they are an outlier, right? They are way more deadly than their hit dice suggests that they should be. And that holds up, frankly, in both of our experience. I'll say that ghouls, I have likewise a wonderful anecdote about running ghouls where, again, the party was almost, you know, killed completely. They're trying to extract themselves and run away. One of their party members goes down, and they have to make the call to, like, just leave him. And they say that we are either all going to die or we have to leave our friend behind. They go running back to town, you know, heal up, do whatever they can to, and then basically start planning a rescue mission. How are we going to get back there to rescue our friend who we don't know what state he's in? Is he live? Is he dead? You know, if he's dead, can we be prepared to resurrect? Right. And they start, now we're getting into calculation of, because we're using BX, how many days will he have been dead by the time we get back there and grab his corpse?
Right.
And I'll tell you, it's the one time I can think of in a campaign where I actually had to use the rules that dictate for a lot of the undead types after, you know, what the rules are for, does the player become one of those undead? And in fact, in this case, he did, right? Like, so I, you know, indeed, he had been completely taken down by the ghouls. When the players come back, they come back, they get into the dungeon, there's a room full of ghouls, and one of the ghouls is their friend. And they basically have to kill him again so that then they can take his corpse back to town and get it resurrected. Which was just absolutely delightful. It was just a great scenario.
That feels very Evil Dead-y to me. And you know what? Yeah. I'm not the biggest fan of the Evil Dead movies, but I have seen them somewhat by accident. That feels very in that genre to me. And you know what? I'll say this too, Paul.
Sorry, actually, Evil Dead fans. A friend of mine starred in the Evil Dead the musical. If you can catch it, I highly recommend it. And it's just be aware of whether or not you're sitting in the splash zone. That's all I'll say about that.
Oh God, standard. Here we are with the Wandering DM's Halloween episode, everybody. I'm gonna shake it off afterwards. And the other thing that I'll say, so I have the first edition sample dungeon here in front of me, and the example of play is set there. So the first edition of example play, I will say, ends with the ghouls. So the characters in the text here get to kind of the same place that my players did. One of the characters gets up to a high point to put a rope down to help everybody else up into the other part of it. And the DM rolls for a surprise encounter, coming up the corridor from behind them while they're alone. And it turns, that becomes positive. So the encounter happens and they're surprised and they get attacked from behind by ghouls. And the place where the example of play ends, apparently that DM is also rolling in public, and it says groans occur from the players as a one comes up indicating surprise. The DM then rolls three attacks for that ghoul that grabbed at the busy gnome, and one claw attack does 2 hit points of damage and paralyzes the hapless character, whereupon the DM judges that the other three ghouls would rend him to bits. The end. And we're not even going to roll for it. Just, you've been attacked by ghouls, automatic death, not going to tell you or the other players exactly what happened. They'll have to figure out later, and the DM will not even roll for the attacks. That's how horrifying a situation it is. And that is your canonical, here's how you play D&D, kids, in first edition.
Let's talk a little bit about what makes them so crazy and deadly, right? Like, the interesting thing about ghouls is, if you're looking at the hit die progression of undead, they're fairly low in the chart, right? They're, what are they, 2 hit die?
Yes.
So they're like just above your skeletons and zombies. But one, they introduce a massive attack, right? They have 3 attacks, which is just unlike, I don't know that there's any other 2 hit die creature that gets 3 attacks per round. 2, they have paralysis, right? So that is, you know, that's a lot. Right there. That makes each ghoul very deadly. And then often you're rolling, I can't remember what the number appearing is. What's the number appearing there in that chart, Dan?
In this chart in original D&D, 2 to 24 is what it says.
Right, 2 there. To 24, man. If you're a party of second, third, even fourth level characters, and you're facing off against a group of ghouls who is equal in number to you, I think you're in trouble.
Right. And you've probably succeeded against skeletons, right? They're 1 hit die canonically. Okay. Zombies are 2 hit dice. That's fine. And then, well, here comes the next one. Ghouls, also 2 hit dice on your stepladder there. So we commonly find, I think, particularly for new DMs playing classic D&D, that you're really likely to possibly be close to a TPK the first time you roll up the ghouls.
Yeah, Yeah, I think it's for Supergirl. Let's talk about a specific example that you and I both have some history in, which is A1, right? The first module in the Slayerverse series. I think it's second or third room is full of ghouls, right?
Right. And they appear behind you, if I recall. You walk into a room and they're like on a ledge above your head.
They're
and
on
you can't
a ledge.
See them.
Yeah. So you come into a room and the ceiling is completely destroyed except for a little ledge. So there's a second story room above them and they're hiding up there. And I think I'm going to look it up here. Wait, I've got the text here in front of me. There are eight of them. There are eight ghouls, right? And how many players is A1 for? It's
probably eight because it's a convention game, I'm guessing.
Well, it has a very specific set of characters, if I remember correctly, which there are nine. There are nine characters. So you could have, maybe you're down one, right? So it's very close to an equal number of ghouls to players. They're hiding. They're going to jump out at you. One of the interesting things is the text of A1 actually gives you a lot of the details about ghouls. I don't know if that's just because they were trying to help the tournament run or if this is an early appearance of ghouls, but I think you and I discussed this a bunch, right, in terms of our, because we've both run this scenario. I've certainly run this scenario many times. I don't know if you've run it more than once or not, but we talked a lot about like do you give those ghouls a surprise role, like how, because there's a real concern here that it would be very easy to simply TPK the party in the third room. Done. It's the first combat of the game. Here are a bunch of ghouls, could easily TPK the party.
Agreed. I think by, conventions, by D&D conventions, you should definitely roll for a surprise and give them a bonus. Like, I would think that, like, most of the time in those situations, you'd make it like a 4 in 6 chance of surprise, if not automatic. I think there's a lot of cases where Gygax makes a scenario, an encounter like that, and it just says they get automatic surprise, possibly.
Dan, so, yeah, I'm looking at the text here right in front of my face right now, and I'm realizing I'm wrong. There are eight ghouls and two ghasts.
Oh, no.
On top of that.
No mas.
I bet you and I both have cut those ghasts out just for the sake of like maybe actually letting the party survive. Because that's.
I wish I pulled up my log from the last time I ran it. I would assume I did not do that. As we discussed last week, even when I have fewer players, I usually don't change the set encounters. So I'm guessing I probably didn't do that.
Yeah. But I really enjoy running ghoul scenarios, right? I really enjoy, and I enjoy too weird terrain for my ghouls, but I love it because they're like, they're a little step. They're a nice step in between the mindless zombies and skeletons and your super intelligent vampire types, right? They're kind of an animalistic intelligence, right? They're hungry. They want to eat flesh. They move quickly, right? But there's some nice bits in there, right? Where like their intelligence level is pretty aptly described to write in the rules, right? Where it'll tell you things like, well, once they paralyze someone, they will continue to kill, to attack, to kill and gorge themselves on that character before they move on, right? Because they're just so driven to consume human flesh.
Right. Now this is a point where I'm gonna jump in, and I could talk about a bunch of different legacy influences, but I think it's an interesting point that what you see ghouls doing in D&D is very similar to how they appear in Romero's Night of the Living Dead, the first of the Living Dead movies. And Night of the Living Dead came out in 1968, and that's in the couple of years where they were starting to develop some D&D ideas. And again, it came out in 74. So they were doing games like that in 73, 72. And I can't help but think that it was on their minds. And if you watch Night of the Living Dead very carefully, at the end, a newscaster comes on the TV to tell you how much worse it is everywhere else, and specifically calls the monsters ghouls. Calls them ghouls several times, as a matter of fact. Right. So it's interesting that most of us nowadays refer to those Living Dead movies as zombie movies, but at least, and of course the creators bifurcated afterwards and you had two different like families of movies. But at least initially they were specifically calling them ghouls. And they moved fairly quickly. They were fairly mobile, fairly sentient. They did, you know, specifically eat their victims. They did possibly create other ghouls. And if you look in D&D, none of those things are things that zombies do. Zombies don't create other zombies. They're not supposed to eat flesh, et cetera, et cetera. But ghouls do. And that's exactly what you see in Night of the Living Dead. So I feel like, you know, if you look at those zombie movies, they're really, at the outset, they're ghoul movies. And that's quite similar, not exactly, but that's quite similar to what we see in D&D. So it makes sense why it's something that you can play around with and has a lot more texture to it than just plain D&D zombies.
It's a good point. It's a good point, right? Like, I feel like in more modern filmmaking, right, especially around the zombie trope, you start to see a lot of stuff like fast zombies versus slow zombies, right? Yep. But one could certainly argue that fast zombies are just ghouls, right? Surely they're just ghouls.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think so. That's how I take it myself. Yes.
Yeah.
Which I think is elegant and efficient.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that ghouls are so well known. I feel like you know, the term means something to people, right? It just shows up in literature a lot. Or I feel like even just saying that someone looks ghoulish, right, is a thing.
Yes, exactly.
But I can't think of any specific like films that very specifically reference them as ghouls, right? That say like, this is a movie about ghouls.
Except for Night of the Living Dead, right? After that, you tend not to get that. Yeah. I will also point out that when we started this year, you're totally right. I mean, ghoulishness is clearly a recognized adjective. And I'll say that when we started this show today in the chat, Gottfried Neuner, the first thing he thought of it was, so you're talking about WotC today was when we said it was going to be a ghoulish discussion. So, yeah.
That's hilarious. And there's another mechanical issue I want to bring up about ghouls I want to ask you about, which is specifically elves. Elves, sometimes, maybe, are immune to ghoul paralysis.
Yeah, the time, right? In every version of D&D that I could find, they are immune to elves. Steve K brought that up a couple minutes ago, said, as soon as we started talking about ghouls, said, better have an elf or two in the party. And I'll say that this changed when my new D&D players encountered ghouls and brushed up against their closest TPK. The play changed texture just based on that. Is they had one or two elves, and specifically our friend Lauren's, the elf was not immediately killed, so they managed to help, you know, avoid the TPK there. And after that, my players, when they wanted to go out and specifically hire henchmen and were always posting ads specifically for elves, we will only hire elf henchmen. We only want elven henchmen specifically so we can have a front line of elves going into the ghoul crypt area. And that persisted for the whole campaign, is they basically only wanted elven henchmen specifically just for that. So that changed a lot, and it is true that in any edition of D&D I could track down, elves still today in 5th edition, they're immune to paralysis, nobody else is, and that's a big deal.
It's such an interesting ruling, because I can't, or maybe not ruling, but an interesting rule, right? Because one, I always forget where to look for this. Is this in the description of elves or in the description of ghouls? I never remember, and I have to go hunting for it. Mm-hmm. You know, so here I'm looking at the AD&D first edition monster manual, and it says their touch causes humans, including dwarves, gnomes, half elves, and halflings, but excluding elves, to become rigid paralysis until saving throw versus paralyzation is successful. What's the origin of this? Why are elves immune to ghouls?
Okay, Paul, let me make this very clear. Paralysis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me make this very clear. Elves are awesome. Elves are amazing in all ways. And And Paul, I'll remind you when we did when we went through Dyson's mini mega dungeon, Dyson's Delves. I can remind you that most of our party, I think possibly at my urging, were elves, and there were many times where we were chanting pro elven chants as we delved. Yep. So viewers, if you want to go check out our playthrough of Dyson's Delve, you're going to see a lot of elf play with me being something of an instigator there. So yeah, I mean, you know, it is true that arguably elves are in fact overpowered in traditional D&D. That's not a crazy argument to make. And that's one of the things that they excel at. They're also mostly immune to charms and sleep spells in first edition D&D.
Yeah, they're immune to a lot of stuff. But so
yeah,
here's but so let me get back to this though. Do you have any idea where historically that's inspired from? Is there any literature where elves are immune to ghouls? They're specifically. It seems like such a specific ability.
I agree. Now, I'll say that I think at least in 5th edition D&D, they added a justification for that, and they created a cosmic backstory where the first ghoul was actually an elf, and then later begged forgiveness from the other elven deities, and they gave him mercy, and as a result, all the other elves are likewise immune to ghoulish attacks. Which
that sounds like a real attack.
I just recently saw
backport.
Right.
When I
started reading that, I'm like, wait a minute. The first ghoul was an elf. That doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, oh, I see where you're going with that. Oh, okay. Whatever.
Very odd.
Yeah, I don't know. If anybody knows where that comes from, other than just like ghouls are great at everything. Elves are great at everything. I don't know. I don't know where that came from.
Yeah, it's strange. It's strange, and again, like it's confusing, right? Because it is very specifically ghouls, and then you have to start asking, well, does it apply to guests as well? And
it does not.
What? Why not?
Oh, you didn't know that?
I'm being overly enthusiastic with my. I would honestly, I wouldn't know it off the top of my head. I would definitely have to go look, and I would have definitely be sitting scratching.
Yeah. So I'm looking at first edition Ghast right now. The Ghast attacks as a ghoul with regard to paralyzation, and this attack will affect elves as well. Yeah.
So specific. Oh my goodness. Very strange. Very, very strange.
Well, I feel like, okay, someone had ghouls, right? And like, well, what's the trump card for ghouls? And then they were like, well, elves. Elves aren't paralyzed from ghouls because they're special. And then someone said, well, now I need a trump card for the elves being immune. So now I've got ghasts, and they trump the elves from the ghoul.
Oh, goodness.
I feel like it might have been what happened there.
I could see that.
Right? You're being attacked by something that looks like ghouls. And the players go, great, throw the elves up in front. I'm like, ha-ha, it's not actually a ghoul. It's something else, and it can paralyze your elves. Ha-ha, players. How do you like that?
Very strange. Dan, let's talk more about their combat stats, because I know that you dug pretty deep on this stuff, especially when you were writing up your blog posts. Where did you land? Did you end up having... Do you house rule them at all? Do you do anything to combat... The fact that they are ridiculously OP for their hit die listing.
So you know, ghouls are the only undead type that have this one ability that can just take you right out of the combat, right? So obviously, lower level skeletons and zombies don't have special attacks. As soon as you go higher, Whites and Wraiths and Spectres and Vampires, they start having energy drain. And the players all hate energy drain. I get it. It's horrifying. But it doesn't immediately take you out of the fight. Like, at least within the fight, it's only worth about one extra hit value. The ghouls are the only type that have an ability that I usually say, or to combat, take you out of the fight in one hit. The only one. But at least... You know, if you look at original D&D as written 50 years ago, by default, every monster only gets one attack for 1d6 damage. So at least in that context, you can say you're only facing one of these paralyzing attacks per ghoul per round. Now, the problem is a year later, when you look at the first supplement to original D&D, the Greyhawk supplement, that's where Gary goes in and starts going, oh, now you've got a claw-claw-bite routine for a lot of monsters and dragons and horses and things. And if you look at the list where they're modifying the number of attacks, I'll just hold it up in my hand here. Here is the here's a list right here, right? And I've got the undead right above my finger here. And you notice here that for all the undead, only one is being changed. It's just the ghouls. All the other undead still have one attack. And it's the ghouls and only the ghouls that are being given a two claws, one bite routine, and therefore getting three, possibly take you out of the fight attacks per round. So that, to me, that just jumps out as a clear outlier. And I don't know why the other types didn't get claw, claw bites. But for me, but obviously that became sticky. That's what you see in all future editions of D&D through advanced D&D and third edition and so forth. And for me, if I just say I'm playing original D&D, I'm not recognizing the supplement table and the ghouls get one attack, then they're scary, but they're just not instantly murderous. And, you know, for me, like playing through the Slaver series that you were talking about, Paul, I think that's why I could be comfortable with 10 ghoulish monsters attacking the party. Of it's only going to be one attack, not a grand total of 30 attacks per round, which does seem like clearly murderous. So for me, I keep it at one attack, and then if I do run them through my arena calculator, they come out at about 3 hit dice worth of danger. You know, they're actually 2 hit dice. They're about 3 hit dice worth of danger. If you bump up their attacks to 3 per round, that doubles their power. So one of the things that I like is that by having ghouls have one attack, I can throw more of them in the mix. And I can have batches of ghouls like you see, like, you know, like Howard stories, like Conan fights ghouls in a couple places. There's a novella called The Flame Knife that ends with a giant wave of ghouls from the underearth overrunning a city. And I can at least start to play around with that. Whereas if they do have 3 attacks, you have to be pretty careful about that.
Interesting. Yeah. I got to say, like, for me, I feel like the multiple attacks for ghouls is just tradition, I guess, or something about it. Like, I really like it, so I hate to take that away. And then so I start thinking about the inverse of like, well, you could reduce the numbers of ghouls. And I grant you that, yeah, that does kind of take away from that image that we have of being mobbed by them. So I might do something like maybe now start to intersperse them with like maybe they're just a bunch of zombies and a couple ghouls, right? Or otherwise, like, you know, especially, I don't know about you, Dan, but I generally don't tell my players, oh, you're fighting, you know, a pack of ghouls. I'll just say, like, oh, a bunch of, you know, animate corpses are coming after you. And so I like the idea that maybe zombies and ghouls are kind of indistinguishable from each other until they start moving and you start seeing their behavior.
Interesting. I will say for me, you know, nowadays, particularly for new players, I actually do tend to want to signal that. Like, I actually do want to signal the difference and say, they look like they have long infected claws and they're slavering with some kind of toxin from their fangs is actually something that I'll kind of signal them about. You know, like now I see William in the chat here coming up with the idea of maybe the paralysis only kicks in if all 3 attacks happen. I could also imagine tweaking it so that only the bite attack is paralyzing, maybe.
I've heard of that. I've heard of folks also dropping them to 2 attacks. There's one with both hands, which is a single claw attack and one bite.
Yeah.
And maybe only one of those is paralyzing. You know, for me, actually, I kind of like the idea that it's the claws that are paralyzing, right? That they're going to come in with the claws to paralyze you, to pull you in, and then they're going to eat you with their bite attack.
Yeah.
I rather enjoy that. Also, in the inverse, a ruling I use to help mitigate some of the deadliness of ghouls actually comes to us from BX, which is a counter to their paralysis. And I don't know that this exists in any other rule set, but in the entry for ghouls in BX, it says the paralysis of the normal type lasting 2 to 8 turns unless removed by a cure light wound spell.
Right.
So BX specifically allows you to use the cure light wound spell to counter ghoul paralysis. And that I personally really like that because it blends in nicely with what I already do for my reduced deadliness in D&D. And I think I've talked about this before, where I don't use zero as death. I say once you hit zero, we roll in the critical wounds chart, and then you're getting a critical wound. And I generally allow players to use a cure light wound spell or the equivalent in a potion or magic item to remove a critical wound instead of restoring hit points. So it's just like, okay, so now cure light wounds are just becoming this multi-purpose, like I heal one thing, right? Whether that's D6 plus one to hit points or a critical wound or the removal of paralysis, ghoul paralysis specifically.
Right. Yeah. That's a good reminder because I think you're right. That's not in other editions of D&D. And I do feel that that's probably Tom Moldvay saying, yeah, ghouls are kind of overpowered. I want some way that the players can counteract what's the horrible thing that's happening here. Now, I will say that this brings up an interesting point of like, how long does the paralysis last? And and that wasn't stated in the earliest rules, like original D&D or even the books for advanced D&D, didn't state you're just paralyzed the end. That's it. I mean, you're at least out of the combat period, and it actually doesn't say. And the funny thing, Paul, is that the first place where you ever get a duration for ghoul paralysis, and I know that you and I both love this product, is in 1982, TSR started developing a product called the Monster Cards, the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Monster Cards. And we both have sets of these. And hypothetically, you could like show the picture to the players. And then on the back side here, the DM has all the statistics to run it with, and you could use that on the other side of the screen. And if eagle-eyed readers will find there's some changes, there's some small changes between the advanced D&D text and these cards. Sometimes they add stuff, sometimes there's errata. And specifically, if you look at the ghoul card with this wonderful art by Errol Otis, and I will point out that I actually have, when I pulled up my monster card pack this morning, this is the card that I have on top. I actually have this card on top specifically for this reason, because it's the first place that they specified a duration of paralysis. And it is back here. On this card, it says that the paralysis lasts 2d6 turns unless a save versus paralysis was made. Now, I will remind viewers that in D&D, a turn was 10 minutes. So on average, the paralysis would last like around 70 minutes in game. So clearly, with no recovery possible, clearly you're out of the fight. No questions about that.
What is what's the date on those cards? When were those produced?
82.
Okay. 19. Well, then I will contradict you in one place in that.
Oh no!
There's an earlier mention of the duration of ghoul paralysis in A1. This is one of the fascinating things I found about A1.
Oh,
right? Again, it's unclear whether A1 is describing how ghouls work generally or that these ghouls are different, right? But it specifically says, you know, there are this many ghouls, blah, 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 and there's so-and-so guests. And it says, when anyone enters the room, the ghouls and guests will leap from above, howling. Oh, they'll surprise you on a 1-4 on a D6.
That's what I said! That's what I just said!
Once a character has been paralyzed by a ghoul or ghast, the monster will continue to attack that character, automatically hitting unless distracted by someone else. Ghoul paralysis will last for 3 to 12 turns.
Oh.
3 to 12 turns, which is a different number. A different number from BX and a different number from the cards. That's bizarre.
Interesting. They both max out at 12, right? They actually agree on that. Well, so this is
2d6. BX is 2d8. It's wildly inconsistent between all three of them, which I find hilarious. Also, the other thing that jumps out at me is interesting, that note about how they will continue to attack the character automatically hitting. Because let me go back to BX. Here's my description of ghouls in BX. It says, once an opponent is paralyzed, the ghoul will then turn and attack another opponent until either the ghoul or all the opponents are So until either the ghoul or all the opponents are paralyzed or dead. So BX says, no, they're going to skip on. They're going to try and paralyze everyone and then feast. Whereas A1 says, as soon as they have a victim in front of them, they're going to eat them.
Well, this is an interesting question because one question you might ask tactically is which of those options is more dangerous? Like which of those ones is more perilous? Because if you're attacking someone who's down for free, you're getting automatic damage. That at least that particular target might perish quickly. But on the other hand, if you go wrong, you maximize your paralysis distribution, that might take the whole party down quicker. So it's an interesting question. I don't know. Players, if you're fighting ghouls, which would you prefer? Would you prefer the ghouls to be focusing attacks on people who are down, or would you rather them focusing attacks on people that are up? That's an interesting dilemma, actually.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and I'm looking at the first edition monster manual, which I think just doesn't give me any advice at all on this. It just doesn't mention it.
Yeah,
agreed. For me, what I personally prefer the A1 description over BX. Here's an unusual case where I actually don't prefer the BX ruling. I prefer that they continue to attack their victim because I feel like it's more in theme for what I want from them. Right? They are a horrifying, single-minded, you know, flesh-consuming machine, right? They want to knock someone down, and then they're just so overwhelmed by their hunger for human flesh that they're going to immediately start chewing on them until they're dead, without regard to what else is going on around them.
I agree. I'd say the same thing. I think, again, if I think of, like, Night of the Living Dead, I think they tend to, like, pigpile on the possible feasting that's happening there. So I agree with that. I almost feel like the we're going to move on to somebody else felt like a DM being a little kind, like, I'm not going to murder you because you're down, but then accidentally actually making it more dangerous as a result.
Yeah, I agree. That sounds kind to the individual and cruel to the party, right? I like the way it changes the tactics, right? I like that it's sort of like, it reminds me of like Sturge fights, honestly. Somebody gets suddenly, swarmed by one of these things, and the party goes, well, we got to save our friend, right? Like now our goals in this fight have just shifted. And I like that a lot.
Yeah. Or, right, someone's down and this is an opportunity to sacrifice them and escape. Like they're focused on the food. Now this is actually our opportunity to save ourselves. Maybe that happens for certain characters, right? I agree with that. Yeah. I think that's how I would prefer to play it myself. Now the other thing I gotta bring up before we run out of time is that my thesis is that ghouls have paralysis in D&D by accident. I actually think that they stumbled into ghouls having paralysis unintentionally. And the reason that I say that, this is the one piece of text that I prepared digitally, Paul.
Okay, great way to put it on the screen. So
if you look at chainmail, right? If you look at the precursor, if you look at chainmail in the fantasy supplement, the last fantasy monster, I believe, is the last monster in that supplement, is a block, and they tend to have them batched up. It actually says whites. This is a paragraph about whites. And then parenthetically, it says, oh, and ghouls. If you have ghouls, you're going to run them like this as well. And it says, their foot figures, whites melee like this. They defend like this. They can be harmed by normal missile fire. They can see in darkness. And then the specific thing that I've got highlighted is if they touch a normal figure in chainmail during melee, it becomes paralyzed and remains so for one complete turn. And then it says, so therefore melee can occur for only one round. And then right at the end, it says zombies are also in this class. Now, where does the paralysis for whites come from? And clearly, if you look in Tolkien, in Lord of the Rings, the barrel whites canonically have an icy touch. You're fighting barrel, they have an icy touch, kind of freeze you and make you unable to move as well. And pretty evidently to my eye, this is, again, talking about Tolkien's barrel whites, freezing you is their extra special ability in combat. And then the fact that you just happen to have, I mean, so no prior version of ghouls paralyze people. You don't see that in Lovecraft. You don't see that in Howard. You don't see that in Lieber. You don't see that in Night of the Living Dead either. You don't paralyze somebody in combat, but they just happen to be glued in this paragraph for whites. And then when you move forward to the original D&D text, which is the bottom of this screenshot, it says, as stated in chainmail for whites, we were talking about whites there, ghouls paralyze any normal figure they touch, excluding elves. And there you get that exception there. Otherwise, you know, they do kind of normal type stuff. And I'll say that actual whites were converted to have energy drain. And all the higher class undead all had energy drain, whereas initially the whites were the ones that were supposed to have the freezing touch paralysis, and that, kind of like your appendix, happened to get stuck and happened to get sticky for ghouls. And they're unlike any type of prior literature. They're unlike any type of pulp influence. And they, to my eye, they kind of had paralysis by accident. Sometimes I really think about removing the paralysis entirely. If I want ghouls that are like Lovecraft or like Night of the Living Dead, you know, they do, like, what is common is that they can infect people and they can become ghouls who survive later on. And that's different, right? And so in D&D, you become a ghoul if you die to a ghoul. But in all the prior literature, you become a ghoul if you get attacked and live. Later on, you transform. And there are times when I consider translating my ghouls into that kind of format, whereby the problem is actually if you live after a ghoul attack. But that would be obviously very different from what his expectation is in D&D.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Fascinating. You know, I'm sitting here staring at the OD&D text as you were describing it there. And then I happen to like scroll back into the stats, and I'm like, wait, okay, so OD&D tells us, you know, yes, it's unusual that they're kind of lumped together in chainmail, and I'm extra confused by the zombies are also in this class.
Right.
Oh boy. Yeah. Wait, did they have three attacks in OD&D though? Is there multiple attacks?
Nope.
Yeah, I don't see that anywhere.
Not in the book as written. A year later in the supplement, but no monster. Well, I mean, except for Hydras. I guess I can think of Hydras and a purple worm. Other than that, nothing in original D&D has multiple attacks.
Yeah, that's what I was just looking for. I was like, am I missing this? But okay, that's...
Definitely not. Definitely not.
I mean, I personally love it. I love the paralysis. I love the multiple attacks. I love everything about ghouls. They're scary. I like that they're scary, that they're weird outliers. So I think that's why I'm kind of inclined to try and find more ways to help the players counteract, right? You know, from like elf immunity to, you know, undoing the paralysis with cure light wounds, rather than ramp down the deadliness of ghouls. I think for me, I could see an argument for reducing them to two attacks, but I'd hate to only give them one. I feel like that would make me sad.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Me, I like them having one attack, and then you get more ghouls.
You get more of them.
What makes me sad is to have fewer ghouls.
I mean, the other thing I do really enjoy with ghouls is putting them in interesting terrain. I wanted to call this out just if we have time here. I was trying to think of other places where I've run ghouls and whatnot, and I was reminded of the Vile Crypt of the Reawakened Sisterhood, or R.A. Salvatore presents the Vile Crypt of the Reawakened Sisterhood, a PDF that I published on DM's Guild. And yes, did in fact, this is born out of when I was playing regularly in R.A. Salvatore's group and then ran this for them. So specifically this whole module focuses on gnolls, but undead gnolls. And so I have, ghoulish gnolls and gnoll whites and spectral gnolls and all kinds of stuff like that in there. The one encounter that really focuses on the ghouls is I have this room. I'm just going to read it to you just a little bit here because it delights me to do so. I hope that's all right. Which says that... here we go. So it's a long hall. There are images of Gnollish priests being servile to Yanagu, receiving his blessing, etc., etc. There's four large pillars, and painted on the ceiling above them is a Yanagu staring down at you know, menacingly. And anyone who walks straight between the pillars, ignoring Yanagu, will fall through a pit. And in the pit below, there's some murals painted around here, which I forgot was in an earlier room. There's some murals painted around of them tossing their dead into pits. And so the floor will open up, and underneath is a pit filled with water, floating in which are just hundreds of corpses. And some of them are ghouls.
Oh, wow.
And it's just that's a delightful, nasty. It's really great because you get your pit trap, but at the pit trap, the fall doesn't actually hurt you because you're landing in a nice, soft pool of water with floating corpses in it. But that's horrifying. And then as you're trying to scrabble out of that, some of the corpses are trying to attack you, maybe paralyze you. And then now there's the threat of drowning. You get paralyzed while you're down there in the water. Maybe, hopefully, the way it's triggered, the whole party doesn't go tumbling down. So maybe you got some people up above trying to help and figure out how to help. So I really enjoy that. Similar to A1, right, where they're hanging out on a balcony. I like the ghouls bouncing off of unusual terrain. Just, I don't know why that makes me happy. And I like mixing them in with normal dead.
Yeah, I think I've seen you run that encounter, or maybe I was actually acting as the adversary in that session for a little while. And I remember that being really memorable, really scary. I mean, and in general, one of the nice things about undead is that you can stick them in places normal people can't live. So a place without air, a place that's too hot, a place underwater, you can stick them in places that it doesn't seem like things could survive as a result. So that's really nice. I will say, Paul, I don't know if you were aware, so... You know, gnolls, as of advanced D&D, are, you know, hyena-headed, are related to hyenas. And I don't know if you're aware that the initial mythology around ghouls comes from Arabian mythology. And initially, they were identified as some kind of demonic creature that lived in graveyards and could shape change, transform themselves commonly into hyenas. Is actually the first thing that they're connected to, as a matter of fact. And there's some, you know, possibility that this might be there's an African disease called Kuru, to my knowledge. And unfortunately, it causes muscle deterioration. So early on, the person isn't moving quite right. They're kind of shuffling to get around. And then in the later phases, they actually lose all muscle control and start laughing hysterically. Lose control of their emotions and start laughing hysterically like a hyena. Huh. So there is some thought that the whole idea of ghouls might actually be an echo of this Kuru disease that causes people to act like a hyena ultimately. So if you weren't aware about that, you've got some kind of Jungian thing going on there with Crypt of the Vile Sisterhood, Paul, that you injected in there, because that's actually kind of where the origin of ghouls is from.
I mean, I could see it, right? And there's a nice overlap there of hyenas being a scavenger, right? And ghouls, you know, often being seen scavenging crypts and graveyards and such to consume dead flesh, right? So that's fascinating. I know it's part of the fun of ghouls, I think, right? Is they're weird. I don't know any other monster type, honestly, that kind of rides the line of being vaguely cannibalistic like this, right? Because in theory, ghouls were once people. Right. And now they want to eat people, which is, you know, kind of horrifying.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. You know, I'm going to say one before we wrap up. Ghouls were, again, they're probably the most scary thing that happened in my original D&D game coming out of Advanced. And I'll just kind of fast forward and say I did play a couple sessions of 5th edition. Our big bad show obviously used 5th edition rules that we were running. But as a player, I'll say that I have never been so startled about the difference in the rules as when we fought ghouls. So, you know, and generally, you know, D&D has evolved to be a little bit safer over the years, a little bit safer to the players. And so we have first level 5th edition characters go into a dungeon and a couple rooms in, we get attacked by ghouls. And so I start, as some people have seen me do a play with me, start giving very clear directions to the new players. And I try not to do that a lot, but I'm like, we're gonna die. We're gonna die. So we need to avoid, get armored people up front, avoid the ghoul attacks. If someone goes down, protect them. I'm like, protect ourselves from the ghoul. Well, I get hit, right? I have a fighter, so I'm trying to protect people. I get hit right off the bat. I miss my save. I'm paralyzed, and I'm like, God damn it. I'm like, I'm out of the fight. We're probably gonna TPK. The turn comes around. The round comes around to when I should have my turn again, and I am shocked when the DM says, make another save. You get to make a save every single round to recover from the ghoul paralysis, and the save is not very hard. It's like it's a constitution with a target check of just 10. And if I have any con bonus at all, I'm probably going to make it. And I was stunned, because my whole concept of you get attacked by ghouls and you're in mortal peril. The people are going to go down. You're not going to get them back. You're going to, you know, have increasing death spiral as your party goes down. And I was like, oh, well, this is nothing. Well, then I'm like, oh, well, I'm not concerned about this at all. This is nothing. We're all going to come back. No problem. And I have, if you contrast, you know, AD&D's probably 70 minutes of paralysis with no possible recovery to fifth edition of unlikely to spend more than 6 seconds paralyzed. As far as I'm concerned, ghouls are completely not scary in fifth edition. And I was not stunned by any rules change more than that specifically for ghouls in the current edition of D&D.
It's interesting, because ultimately I feel like it's just trying to solve the question of the unknown duration of ghoul paralysis, right? Like it's not documented how long ghoul paralysis lasts. And I feel like doing a periodic random check, whether that's a saving throw or something else, is just a way of adding, you know, variety to the duration of the paralysis. Now, it's a very, very generous one, right? Because like you said, right, it's very likely that you're going to make that save in within a handful of rounds, right? And, you know, maybe probably the second one, maybe soon after. So so it certainly ramps stuff down. You know, I would argue that the tens of minutes is just too much, right? Like the you're paralyzed, you're out for the entirety of everything. That I would much rather see it in terms of rounds rather than turns. I think that's and that I'd be tempted to go that route, honestly, as I'm thinking about it now. Like let's have it be potential to wear off. I don't know.
I see that. You know, arguably there's an efficiency factor of just like it's just one more thing you have to track. So I can actually see you go down, you're out of the fight, we're just not going to worry about it anymore. And I will say, as a really old school player, I will also say, looking at the original D&D text, it doesn't give a duration. So hypothetically, maybe it's permanent. And also, I will also point out, technically, original D&D doesn't say you get a saving throw either. You can interpret and say, maybe you're supposed to. But you know what? It doesn't say that for energy drain either. And most of us traditionally don't give saving throws for the energy drain attacks. So as far as chainmail and OD&D is concerned, you ghoul just touches you. You're permanently paralyzed, technically, according to the text. So, Paul, anything more generous than that is a sign of how weak and frail our culture has become. And giving saving throws and giving any limitation on the duration is frankly a pale imitation of the original. And I will forgive people who play that way, but nonetheless, my opinion stands.
Interesting. I don't know. I'm going to put up a comment here. I agree with Kilroy here. Paralysis for D4 or D6 rounds is still really scary and, you know, but possibly bearable. The other thing I would lean into here is like, yes, if you're paralyzed for D6 rounds, let's say, but you're also going with my preferred, and then the ghoul continues to attack you. Is he not just re-upping that paralysis round after round after round?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I can see that. Sure.
But I agree with your point of like, yeah, it does make the bookkeeping a little unpleasant. To which end, I there is some elegance there to the fifth edition rule of like, well, I'm just going to let you resave every round, right? Then at least the bookkeeping is now on the person who's out, right? So they're
you know what, involved, there are right? things the person,
there, it there involves are things that person that, in the sequence. Yeah.
Well, you know what, I actually don't like that. You know that part, Paul. I personally actually don't like. So I as a player, I actually have had bad experiences in places such as like Warhammer, where I was down or dying or something like that, and I was actually kind of aggrieved at having to remain at the table making do I die saves and not actually getting to do anything around when I personally would have preferred to just get up and go get a snack. There are actually a lot of things whereby rolling each round does make the record keeping more elegant. I would totally concede that a lot. That particular bit I've actually had bad experiences with as a player. Just rolling to see, yep. I'm down, I can't do anything, do I die? That's not actually a great thing to interact with.
I see your argument. I do like that it puts it in the player's hands, right? That the player, they're taking a little ownership, right? If they just continue to fail the save over and over and over again, right? Then they're, you know, at least they're not saying like, you curse you terrible rotten DM. They're like, ah, I can't seem to roll above a 4. What is going on? Why am I having such a terrible time? Right. So I like that, but I can see where you're coming from. And then the variable, like it takes this many rounds. Agreed. The problem with that is sort of, it adds bookkeeping, which is unfortunate, but
yeah.
I don't have a silver bullet here. Unfortunately, we're out of time. So we're just going to have to leave it there. Dan, any final thoughts on ghouls?
Well, I think I've made my opinions clear, Paul. I actually do like my ghouls with just one attack, like in the original D&D. I can use larger numbers that way. I kind of want to use them like you see them in Lovecraft. There are times when I'm not entirely sure I even want them to be undead. I like them having some sentience, something that you can actually communicate with. In Lovecraft stories, you know, they actually have a society. They're actually opposed to Ghasts. They actually help the protagonist in the dream quest of Unknown Kadeth. So I do kind of like having an opportunity to use ghouls for kind of more textured type stuff. And I like having them in big, you know, mobs and possibly villages or something like that. And if I hang my hat on I'm playing the way original D&D did, I'm actually pretty happy with it.
Interesting. Interesting footnote there of the having societies. You know, we never even got to Lieber's unusual ghouls are just a race with transparent skin thing. I actually don't like that. I'm not a fan. Personally, I prefer
show the picture.
I'm trying to talk, can't talk and click at the same time. So I prefer a more animalistic approach. I prefer ghouls that are just a horrifying, horrifying monster that they're out to eat you. So I don't want any society. I don't want any real, like, very logical thought. I like that they're a gradation above complete mindless automaton of the zombie and skeleton, but below you're more actively thinking whites, wraiths, vampires, etc., etc. For me, I don't want to cut their deadliness in terms of their number of attacks or the paralysis, the ability to paralyze, but I feel like I'm a little more willing to talk about things like reducing the duration of the paralysis or giving other routes away from the paralysis. So ultimately what I land on is just kind of like my typical approach, which is just to lean into BX. Well, BX tells me I can cure the paralysis with a cure light wound so that it only lasts 2 to 8 rounds. That makes me pretty happy. That's where I'm landing. All right. Show the picture. Which one is the picture, Dan? Which one is the Liber?
The one with the purple. And an axe. There's an axe in it.
Purple.
So what Paul's pulling up here is that in Liber's Lankmar, Nuon Ghouls, and here this picture is from the Advanced Deities and Demigods book. And the illustration is by friend of the show, late Janelle Jacques, and we miss her so much. And what a great artist. And the ghouls in Lankmar had transparent skin and organs. So you could only see their bones. The Grey Mouser had a relationship with one of them and found the bones to be very comely, quote unquote.
I thought it was Stafford who had relations with one of them.
Oh, I might be mistaken.
Yeah.
And
it's super weird. It's such a weird thing. Unlike any other ghoul that we've seen in other settings.
They were intelligent. They had a society. If you look at the outline in this illustration by Janelle Jacquoyes, it is a very shapely, a feminine outline, actually. It's very sexy, except that, you know, you're seeing through it and just seeing bones, which makes it really creepy. So there's a lot of ways you can run your ghouls. And I would say to DMs, it's an opportunity to surprise your players. You could do this. You could do it like Lovecraft. You can have them like beasts. You can have them be like Arabian mythology. You can totally tweak how their paralysis, their attacks, or how creating ghouls work. It's actually a great opportunity for a scary D&D game where you surprise your players with exactly what the horror is today. And there's a lot of options there.
Funny. I want to say, too, that Lieber still made them cannibals. Weren't they also still cannibals
in the...
it was very weird. Anyway, viewers, if you have opinions on how to run ghouls in your campaign, are they too deadly? Are they OP? If so, what house rules do you want to implement? Are you just running them by the book? If so, which book? It seems like there's a lot of variety. Leave us a comment in the YouTube video here. We'd love to hear from you on how you run ghouls, and maybe that will spin us up a new conversation down the road.
I bet it will. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. Have the handle Wandering DMs on all of the sites. So please look for this there and take a big bite out of that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also through various podcast carriers such as iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those sites and it gives you the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server, where the conversation is continuing round the clock 24/7 about old D&D and new D&D and science fiction miniatures and horror games and all the stuff that we adore and love. So we would love to see you there, including the live after chat that will start in about 10 minutes. And I'm sure we have more stuff to talk about regarding ghouls, and probably you do too, so we want to hear all of that. I will point out that next week we're going to be off because I think you're wandering, Paul.
That's right. I'll be up at the Carnage Convention up in Vermont. I'll be running a lot of Fearful Ends and maybe a little D&D as well. If you're attending that convention as well, seek me out. Say hi.
Great stuff. So we'll be back in 2 weeks will be the plan, and don't forget, of course, we are live almost every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again in 2 weeks for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.